22-2005. Mr. Wasserman, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please this honorable court and all those in attendance. I'm Attorney Lou Wasserman. I'm here for Jalen Bertram. With the court's permission, I'd like to begin by requesting a clarification. Because of the recent flurry of activity, after all briefing, an oral argument was set. On the 24th of July, court issued an order ordering the U.S. to supplement the record on appeal with the DVR footage recovered from appellant Jalen Bertram's home. Based upon everything that I'm sure this court read, that seemed like a very reasonable request and one that could be relatively easily completed, which is why this court said do it by July 31st. Then the very same day, the government, in what I'm going to call, just me maybe, the dog ate my homework response, the government says, well, it's not a DVR. It was mentioned at the change of plea sentencing hearing, but it's on an external hard drive. And by the way, there's 2 terabytes of information to go through because Bertram had multiple surveillance cameras. Oh, and the assistant U.S. attorney, he's out of the office for the week. I have the hard drive, but I can't access it because it's encrypted and I don't have the password, so we need more time. This court gave them more time. So the first question I have, if you don't mind, is, all right, what are we going to do when that video footage comes in? Do I, on behalf of Mr. Bertram, have an opportunity to look at it and respond and file something? Depending upon what, if anything, the government comes up with. And it's important because, permit me this, as I've hinted at in my briefs, I contacted trial counsel, this is by way of offer of proof, and said, what are we talking about here with regard to videos? And she sent me a link to a single 32 megabyte, 2-minute and 1-second Snapchat video, and you can clearly tell it's a Snapchat video because there's 2 windows and it says so, showing at one point Mr. Bertram sitting on a couch with what appears to be a weapon on the couch next to him. That's it. That's all that I was supplied with. Now I learned from the U.S. attorney, we all learn, there's 2 terabytes worth of material that they have to go through. That's nice. But what I want to be able to respond to with this court's permission is how much of that, if any, was turned over to defense counsel? How much of that, if any, other than the 1 2-minute segment that she supplied me with, did she show to Mr. Bertram, have him go through it and say, oh yeah, that's what I did, I'll plead to that. The problem is you can't tell any of that based on this record. And that's why, in my view, the fault, the ultimate fault, lies with the colloquy, the lack of colloquy, if you will, with the district court judge. All the court had to do was, Mr. Bertram, you understand the difference between carrying and possessing and brandishing.
And that's all the defense counsel would have had to raise, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, in the first instance, yes. But in the plea colloquy, it becomes the responsibility of the district court judge.
Of course, but yes. we're in plain error territory here, correct?
Yes, this is not a motion to withdraw a plea. That's correct.
And none of these problems were raised in the district court?
No, none of them. No, that's true. Okay.
Do you agree that under Greer, the entire record is available to determine whether there's a factual basis for the plea?
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. That brings us to document 128, the government's factual basis, where on the page 2, it recites the statutory language. The defendant knowingly carried a firearm, but then in the factual basis, as the government has conceded it did. It says possessing.
Yes.
Yes.
And that's the problem in the case. The question I asked is, doesn't Greer let us look at the entire record when
yes.
we're evaluating whether this is something that requires reversal under the plain error standard?
Well, this court is now, yes, it does, but this court has now decided to give the government the opportunity to supplement the record. I'm merely asking for that same privilege.
I'm confident you would have it.
Thank you. All right. Nonetheless, all the district court had to do, in my view, Mr. Bertram, do you understand the difference between these three terms?
Now, this is an easily correctable mistake. It could have been corrected by the district judge, by the prosecutor, or by defense counsel, right?
Correct.
Okay, so the question, though, is where's the prejudice? Where's the harm to your client in this case?
I would say that
this is calling out for a reversal on an issue that was never raised in the district court.
Because carrying and possessing carry different penalties, one of which was imposed here for carrying a firearm in furtherance of this conspiracy. If he's not carrying, then the worst case scenario is you have another grouped count of possessing a firearm.
Wait, I don't understand that. They're both 924C charges. Possessing a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking offense carries a 5-year mandatory minimum, stacked on top of the other count, just like carrying does. It's just a different way to prove the same crime.
That's, I think, a different way of looking at it than what was presented.
But that's just the statute. I mean, what Judge Kirsch is talking about is the language of the statute, which takes you back to Judge Hamilton's question about prejudice. Because if people were talking about possession instead of carrying, and yet it's plain that he carried, I mean, it would have taken 1 second to correct that at the district court. And if the sentencing consequences are no different, is there prejudice? Is this the kind of thing, looking at element 4 of the plain error standard, that the reputation and integrity and so forth of the judiciary depends on?
I have a different view of this. I'm sorry, but I do. And my view of this comes down to what did Mr. Bertram knowingly and voluntarily plead to? Now, are we going to rewrite that and say it doesn't make any difference because the penalties aren't any different? I think the penalties are potentially different. And maybe I can go back and look at the guidelines and demonstrate how they'd be different. Maybe they'd be different statutorily. But they're certainly going to be different in boots on the ground on the day of sentencing in this unusual, from my perspective, unified proceeding of both a plea and a sentencing, where terms are conflated, where arguments are made that have no basis in what actually happened in Mr. Bertram's apartment. The government's factual basis was inaccurate. The district court's colloquy was inadequate. Defense counsel made, if you will, the same clear error, to put it at that level, that the other parties made, and that is, kid, just say yes, ma'am, which is all that he ever said, other than his name. And so I think if we're talking about the integrity of the process, I am concerned. You might even ask, why was there no plea agreement in this case? Does that matter? That certainly matters, because that allows the U.S. attorney to make any argument that they want to make at the time of sentencing. So why wasn't there a plea agreement? District court judge didn't ask that as well. Maybe they know.
The district judge would be on pretty thin ice asking why there's not a plea agreement, intruding herself or himself into potential negotiations. That's a minefield.
Well, I
in federal court.
I understand. And it didn't happen. And although it might be thin ice, it didn't add to the integrity of the process for the court to go through this entire process with facts that, in my view, are inaccurate, and a defendant who never really indicated he understood the difference in the terminology. And that really is, in my view,
what should we do if we see on the DVR the defendant packaging drugs with a gun on his hip?
That'll be new. I'm not going to comment on that till I see it too, because that isn't on the one video segment that was sent to me by defense, which, by the way, I'll be happy. I guess I'm done. Unless Majors answer that question. I'd be happy to supplement it with the one video that I have as well, with the court's permission.
All right, thank you, Mr. Watts, Mr. Wasserman. Mr. Rice, do you have anything I'd like to add here?
I feel like, may it please the court, Brian Wrights for the United States. I feel like I'm obliged to approach the subject of the DVR surveillance videos quickly. We have downloaded them from the external hard drive onto the computer. We talked to the clerk's office, so we plan to send the whole external hard drive to the court, hopefully overnight, it either today or tomorrow. I guess we are outside of the record land, but Mr. Bertram actually proffered and watched DVR surveillance videos with his attorney and agreed that it was him and that those were drugs and guns. So the
What was presented to the court, though? What's in the actual record for Judge Pratt?
The PSR's explanation of the DVR. No one ever actually
introduced this material.
Correct. There was no reason to introduce the material because, again, Mr. Bertram pleaded guilty, and this information about the DVR was in the PSR, and it was mentioned at the guilty plea in the sentencing hearing. It sort of defies credulity that a defense attorney would have had this compelling, incriminating evidence mentioned by the government and not object to it if it was an unknown, unheard of piece of evidence. I think that's why he pleaded guilty.
Well, we're in a land where there was a lot of mistakes made.
I think one.
Well, by several people, however.
Yes, we agree that we said the wrong word.
Said the wrong word. It's the wrong crime. And so we kind of start from the premise that improbable things can have happened in this case. So have you seen the DVD?
Not all of it because it's days of footage, but yeah. I've seen enough of the video to tell you it is DVR surveillance footage.
Give me the highlight, if you would.
So this is new to me, but Mr. Bertram had surveillance videos not only outside but inside his house. So we have a video of his living room mm-hmm. with him packaging drugs with Mr. Gross, and he is holding a gun. Sometimes they're holding guns and dancing, for lack of a better term. Any attorney that would have seen this would have encouraged their client to plead guilty, and that's what happened here. Okay. And I'm confident when the court receives the hard drive, it'll be apparent.
So the trouble is, you know, we've even had cases where, you know, the indictment says, as it does here, maybe that he carried a firearm, but the proof winds up showing something else. And, you know, the indictment clause of the Constitution requires a congruence between what somebody's convicted of and what the indictment says and what they know they're pleading to. So, you know, it's a little troublesome to say, oh, well, you know, we can just look at the record anew and figure out which crimes it reflects.
Well, both are 920Cs, 24Cs, Your Honor. And I think the
it was amended after Bailey. I mean, we've followed this
for decades.
A long time.
But this court's precedents allow, and the rules, I might add, allow the judge to look at the entire record. And the entire record shows that Mr. Bertram carried a firearm.
I asked you what was really in the record. Because, you know, if these surveillance videos are in the record,
they're not, but the PSR established that he carried the firearm while he was packaging the drug and then walked outside. Plus, we have the firearms that we found. One had his fingerprint on it. Four were in a vehicle that was his brother, so presumably he was using it. And we know from Supreme Court precedent, carrying a firearm or transporting a firearm in a vehicle is carrying. So we have evidence besides just the surveillance videos that, again, I agree are outside the record, but the parties had seen them. That's why they're in the PSR.
So you're saying the PSR kind of makes this assertion that he carries the guns around.
Yes, and the assertion was also in the factual basis. I mean, the factual basis and what was discussed at the joint hearing would support carrying, even though, yes, again, the AUSA said possess. And we heard an admission today that this court's precedents allow a look at the entire record. So the entire record does include evidence of his carrying. Of course, this is not a trial, so we don't have the videos as exhibits. It's a guilty plea, and there's less need to put in this, I mean, external hard drive of terabytes of data. I mean, the judge probably wasn't going to watch that, frankly.
Okay.
Do you think we should look at the video?
I think it's difficult because certainly it's helpful for us, but I think it's clear in this video, but I think judges or an appellate court looking at a video without an explanation from an agent is a difficult position. I know I watch these videos and I had someone explaining to me like this is what this is. Now some of it's obvious, but mm-hmm. there's videos of Mr. Bertram walking into his house and there's something on his hip pocket, mm-hmm. and I was explained that that is a magazine because an agent who's an expert in firearms said that's what it was. I wouldn't have known that, and I mean, Your Honors may be better positioned than I am to know that, but I – so I think it – even if it's simpler here, I think it is dangerous territory
I'm wondering if we might not be better off just sticking with the PSR. But
I think this court's precedents and the PSR and what happened to the Rule 11 colloquy are fully sufficient for this court to affirm. And I did want to mention one other thing with the court's permission. The reply brief, I think, hints at a knowing and voluntariness claim. We would say that's waived because it wasn't raised in the opening brief. But to the extent there was any confusion, I would point the court to United States versus Harvey, which is 484 F3rd 453, which deals with another conflation of 924C terminologies. And the court said the phrases used in the two parts of the statute are close enough that the meaning of them, the defendant knew the essence of the charges he was facing. So I think that ends any knowing and voluntariness claim. If there are no further questions, the government would request the court affirm all.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wasserman, you ran out of time, but I'll give you a minute for rebuttal if you have anything you'd like to add here.
Thank you very much. Rely on the PSR by way of offer of proof, and I'll be happy to supplement the record. I talked to Agent Coombs in Evansville. He never saw the DVRs. I'll be happy to supply that email.
Was there any objection to the representations made in the PSR at sentencing?
No.
Isn't that a big problem for your client? Because that happens all the time. I mean, in child pornography cases, for instance, we certainly don't want the government submitting these images to the district judge to look at to determine whether or not it's actual child pornography. The pre-sentence report summarizes it. When the defendant agrees, the judge accepts it as facts. And in fact, the judge at sentencing says, I accept the facts that are unobjected to in the pre-sentence report, and those are my findings of fact. That's it.
Except the PSR in this case is nothing more than a re-recital of the government's factual basis.
It is in most cases. So, unless the defendant objects and says, no, that's wrong, then the government has put to their burden of proof. But when the defendant says, I have no objection, that's it. Usually it's just a summary of 302s.
I don't know. Judge, I always have input into these myself.
Sure.
It isn't just the government's recital, at least in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. We do it that way. One last comment, if you don't mind,
sure.
with regard to counsel over here. I wouldn't have recommended that he plead. Thank you.
You're welcome. Mr. Wasserman, thank you for taking this case. You were court appointed in this case, I believe.
Actually, I want to thank Mr. Wall. He called me and asked me to do this.
Thank you. You're very welcome, and thank you for taking on this case. Okay, our next case is United.